Hello. You've heard a running thread on this show over the last couple of months, unless you're a brand new listener, in which case, welcome. We're a podcast covering the Target novelizations in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. But for those of you longer-term listeners, you'll notice I've been asking all my guests recently, and this is a suggestion from one of my producers, Jim Sangster, which is their favorite Target cover painting. Another producer's note is David Barsky, asking me to make sure that I recorded all my live Gallifrey One interviews in a quiet space. And when I told him the plan for this episode was to record my dinner with Andre style in one of the LAX Marriott hotel restaurants, poor Dave's response was unprintable. In terms of favorite covers, obviously the original Chris Achilleos painting for Doctor Who and the Dinosaur Invasion, and Roy Knipe's cover painting for Death to the Daleks are high in my personal mix. As Billy Joel once said of his most famous songs, those are the ones that grew up to become doctors and lawyers, but he remains the most proud of some lesser-known songs in his ridiculously large catalog. So yes, Dinosaur Invasion and Death to the Daleks grew up to become doctors and lawyers. Those are not the ones that I am the most proud of.
Getting closer. Perspectives start to change. Things look a little strange as we get closer.
But for me, the winner is Tony Mazzaro's cover painting for The Seeds of Death. You can never go wrong with a purple color scheme on a Target novelization, but oh, the color is on the front cover too. The Earth, the big blue marble of the famous NASA photograph, and of the long-running 1970s PBS educational program about diversity on our world, hanging in space surrounded by black sky, white stars, and a bluish, pinkish, purplish nebula, with the ice warrior standing menacingly on the moon's surface, with the moon base behind him, half the warrior in shadow. This is gorgeous.
Tomorrow's just another day to get together. Get closer, closer, closer.
So that's my winner for the best Target cover painting of all time, Tony Mazzaro, Doctor Who, The Seeds of Death, the December 1986 novelization, this week on Doctor Who Literature. Let's get to it.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who podcast network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason. This will be a short introduction. I have been out of town this week. I was in Las Vegas where I visited a terrific used bookstore, Dragon Castle Books, off the Vegas Strip. This is the first used bookstore that I've been to since I lost my collection of the New Adventures that actually sells New Adventures. They had 9 or 10 NAs for sale. Unfortunately, all books that I have already recollected, so no need to purchase them again. However, my lack of purchase may be your gain. If you are short of New Adventures and in the Las Vegas area, this may well be the place for you. Meanwhile, this week, we welcome back to the show Mark from Trap One in an episode recorded over 2 months ago at the Gallifrey One convention in Los Angeles over dinner. I include the entire conversation, recorded live in one of the hotel restaurants, my dinner with Andre style. Please enjoy my conversation with Mark. I will return to Trap One, where I'll be covering each of the first two new Doctor Who Series 1, or if you will, Series 15 episodes, starring Shruti Gatwa as the Doctor, on Trap One. I will be moderating the Episode 1 panel, and I'll be a panelist for Episode 2. That will be in a couple of weeks from now. Those episodes are due to premiere in the States on May 10th, and in the UK on May 11th. You can look forward to catching those on Trap 1 in the not-too-distant future. But for now, a pre-recorded interview with Mark from Trap 1, covering this week's book, The Seeds of Death. Let's get to it.
A Whovian and a Nuvian walk into a TARDIS
and explore every episode of the classic Doctor Who series.
Join me, podcaster John S. Drew,
and me, writer-editor Jim Beard, as we take apart each story starting from the very beginning in 1963.
And join us on our Facebook page and Twitter, where we continue the discussion with you with historical artifacts from British papers of the time. The Doctor's Beard Podcast, released every Saturday around tea time on your favorite podcasting app.
And we'll see you in time and space. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature. Keep turning the pages.
So have you ever seen the movie My Dinner with Andre?
I haven't. When you mentioned it, I looked it up and it wasn't available anywhere on any of the streaming services that I pay every month for. So I still haven't seen it.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Can I get you started with something to drink?
Ice water for me.
Diet Coke, please.
Diet Pepsi?
Yeah, perfect.
And are we ready to order?
I have a question. How many wings come in the wings?
It's 8 wings and it has celery sticks and carrot sticks.
You got yourself a deal. I will do the teriyaki sauce.
Blue cheese or ranch?
Ranch.
Ranch, thank you.
Another big bacon burger, please.
How do you want to cook?
Medium to well.
Medium well?
Yeah, perfect.
And a cousin of fries, is that okay?
Perfect, thank you.
Thank you, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It's actually on YouTube as far as I know, but in the early 80s when it came out, my parents were obsessed. So they would watch it over and over again and just endless discussions about it. So I have not seen it as a grown-up.
You see, the actor, I can't remember his name, it's the guy from The Princess Bride who, I love The Princess Bride and I've loved it all my life, and he's a recurring character in The Good Wife and The Good Fight as well,
yes.
As a kind of like, he's the lawyer of a drug kingpin, the guy who went on to play Luke Cage in the Marvel Netflix stuff, he's his lawyer anyway, so he's very sinister. Quite coming across as quite kind of friendly and kind of harmless to begin with.
He's had a fascinating career because playwright, actor, political writer. His father was a big deal in New York City publishing. So he's been around a long time. I think he's probably best known for Princess Bride among a certain generation, but he's done so much more than that.
Inconceivable.
I do not think that word means what you think it means. So it's basically a dinner between him and Andre Gregory, who was a very famous figure in the theater. So they spend half the movie talking about Andre Gregory and where he's been, the other half just talking about life, the universe, and everything. And it gets very philosophical. But it was not actually filmed in a live restaurant in New York. I think it was filmed in a hotel somewhere in the South. I want to say Virginia or North Carolina. It was a Banner Hotel being used as a set.
So in our scenario, you're the famous person because you just got recognized on the shuttle bus from the airport as a famous podcaster.
I am a short New Yorker, so I am definitely the Wallace Shawn of this scenario. So true story, one of my old office buildings in Manhattan was one floor up from the Criterion Collection, the DVD people.
Yeah.
So you would often have actors, directors coming into the building to visit the Criterion Collection closet and do interviews for their Facebook page or do extra features for the DVDs. And I always loved, we were on 6, they're on 5, whenever the doors opened into their lobby, you would see all their vintage movie posters. So when I was there, it was like Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas or whatever big movie was coming out on this, that particular month. So I once found myself riding in the elevator with Wallace Shawn.
Wow.
And I wanted to let him know that I recognized him, but I didn't want to say Princess Bride or Clueless, because everyone recognizes him from that. And I remembered, about 45 seconds too late, that he had been in this really bad late 80s comedy called Nice Girls Don't Explode.
Right.
It's about a single mom who doesn't want her daughter dating. So she becomes a pyromaniac, and plants explosions, firebomb. So if the daughter ever gets too close to a boy, the mom is standing there with a remote control to activate the explosion. And she tells the girl, if you get too close to a boy, you're going to start a fire.
Right.
So Wallace Shawn is in that movie, and I wanted to say that's where I recognize you from, and he would have loved it, but I didn't have the guts, and he got out before I did, so that's that line is remaining.
It can be hard to know what to say, can't it, in those situations? Yeah.
So you've been this is your first galley, and you've been here for about 10 minutes, and you've already met a bunch of people.
Yeah.
But has anybody recognized you?
Nobody has recognized me, no. I think that would be very unlikely if anybody recognized me.
I actually got recognized on the shuttle bus.
Thank you.
Just based my pleasure.
Thank you. Somebody
juice.
Juice? Messiah? I got recognized from my voice waiting for the hotel shuttle at the airport. It was a surreal experience.
I think that's far more likely to happen to you than to me, but you never know.
You've been in the game a lot longer than I have. You discovered me. You created me.
Well, the aim of the game is to spread the word about Prep 1 while I'm here, so maybe I'll get recognized next time.
Did you bring swag?
I did. I don't know when this is going out, but badges and fridge magnets available for anybody that wants to meet this convention.
This is book 112, episode 111, so it's going out in a couple of months.
Okay.
So you should have surplus by the time this airs, so write to Mark and ask for surplus.
Well, hopefully I'm not taking any home, because at Manchester Airport, when I went through security, my suitcase got flagged, and it was the Trap 1 fridge magnets, because when I ordered them, I thought they'd be round like the badges, but they're sort of cut out round the logo.
Oh, wow.
And the wings of the unit logo, it flagged by the, I guess it's AI with the scanners as a sharp object. So then when I opened it, I had to explain that I was going to a Doctor Who convention, and the woman was like, where are you going? I was like, Los Angeles. It's quite a long way to go. I was like, yeah, it is, yeah.
It would have been better if the security personnel had been a Doctor Who fan and a listener of your podcast.
She did say that she liked the, she said, I like Doctor Who, I like the old stuff, I like Tom Baker. And I said, I prefer the old stuff too.
So we are talking, of course, on Thursday night, so the con has not probably started yet. We've gotten our badges. I've introduced you to a few folks. We have our convention books. By the time this airs, of course, we'll have already released the Track 1 episode. But we'll consider this a preview. What are your expectations for the convention?
Well, I think a lot of my expectations come from talking to you and from the Matthew Jacobs documentary that came out last year.
That's right.
Doctor Who Am I?
Well, that was recorded here like 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah, so I think I'm expecting a lot more cosplay than you get. You get cosplay at UK conventions, but it seemed like, one, it's more prevalent, and one, it's a lot more elaborate here. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing that. And it was just the scale of it as well, like 3,000 guests. I think the only thing comparable I'll have been to was the 50th convention, the XL in London, which was huge. You know, that was enormous. But yeah, I think from what everyone says, you know, American conventions are just kind of more exuberant and enthusiastic and kind of wild. You know.
It's funny when you say exuberant. What Doctor Who media comes to mind whenever you hear the word exuberant?
I don't know.
The 1991 VHS version of Shada with the Tom Baker Lincoln narration. So they send Tom Baker to the Museum of the Moving Image, and he's clowning around with all the Doctor Who props. And one of the cliffhangers was never filmed. I want to say it was the episode 5 cliffhanger. So instead of showing you, this is before the animation, Tom Baker is narrating what happens at the episode 5 cliffhanger. And he goes, and as only Tom Baker could do, compared to Tom Baker, I have the voice quality of a castrated squirrel, so I cannot do it justice, but Skagra was exuberant. To this day, I cannot hear the word exuberant without hearing and seeing Tom Baker performing that cliffhanger.
Skagra ordered the sphere to drain Sallyavin's mind, but K-9 blasted it into pieces. Each fragment reformed into another, smaller sphere, one of which settled on the old man. Skagra was exuberant. You shall see the beginning of the universe.
I have seen that, but that didn't stick in my mind. But the Museum of the Moving Image was one of these things when I was a kid that I would read about every month in the Doctor Who magazine and be desperate to try and go to, but you know, we weren't going to London very often from where I live, which is in the far north of England, very near the Scottish border. We weren't really going to London very often. If it were, it wasn't for a Doctor Who exhibition on a family trip. So
there's one in New York, actually, a similar museum. It's in Queens, right near the Kaufman Astoria Studios, where they make Sesame Street.
Oh, cool.
I have never been, though, even though it's not too far from me, as the crow flies. But I've never been to the UK one. But yeah, cosplaying is a very big deal here. You're going to see some really elaborate ones tomorrow. And our friend Jan has been on both of our shows. She's one of the organizers of the cosplay, the masquerade,
right,
over the weekend. So we'll talk to her about that at the Trap One. Or, for you listeners, you've already heard that episode many weeks ago. The person online who recognized me at the airport shuttle, I was asking how many they've been to. They've lost count. I think I've lost count, too. I lived here. I went here in 2008 for a day. I was supposed to come here for a second time in 2014, long after I moved back to New York, but there was a major snowstorm and I couldn't get out of New York. So I've been here every year since 2015, with two exceptions. One year I missed because there was a Trump-inspired government shutdown and I wasn't getting paid. And then, of course, the COVID year, 2021, they didn't have. I think this is their third year since COVID, so I've been all three. I think it's my ninth overall, as far as I can tell. Now, what's funny, it's like going to the dentist, even though it's so far apart on the calendar, it always seems like it's days apart because it's so vivid. So walking through the hotel, I was like, I was here 5 minutes ago at the Hilton lobby. And I could do the Marriott now with my eyes closed. Although you missed the old downstairs carpet. The downstairs Marriott carpet was legendary.
Yeah,
it was brown and red, and it was very 70s.
I've been seeing on Twitter a lot, that was a big landmark thing for visitors,
And if you're lucky, the ribbons that you wear under your convention badges, there were ribbons that would have an old Marriott carpet design.
Right.
But they pulled it out a few years ago, so now it's a much more muted, not 70s, not garish, now it's a much more muted blue and off-white tone, so you'll see. But yeah, if you watch the Matthew Jacobs documentary, I watched it here last year on the Friday night. Matthew and Vanessa, who've been on Trap One, screened it. And it was filmed here, it was taped here, back when the old carpet was in place. And the collective gasp or sigh of excitement from the audience when they saw the old carpet was incredible. People getting nostalgic for hotel carpeting.
That's the thing. The other thing that I really remember about that documentary, and that movie made me laugh, was the lady that said that she was talking about the difference between American and British conventions. And she said it's, you come to an American one and it was so much more cosplay, or at least everyone's wearing at least a Doctor Who t-shirt and badges and things like that. And the line that I remember is she said, you go to a British convention, it looks like they just scooped a load of people up from a bus stop.
Our friend Nicole is joining us a little bit later in the weekend. She does two cosplays. So she does Pertwee, or Joe Grant, and she does Polly.
Oh,
so she actually does Underwater Man as cosplay. But when I first met her, I recognized her because she was doing Polly from the very end of War Machines.
Right.
And I was one of the people to recognize her as Polly from a very specific episode. And I've also seen her do Polly Highlanders cosplay. So I don't know if she's doing cosplay this year, but if she does, it'll be Polly, or she's got a velvet John Pertwee style jacket.
Brilliant.
Which Katie Manning was all over last year.
Yeah.
This is one of the few galleys that Katie Manning will not be at, unfortunately. But Fraser is going to be here. Fraser, I think, has come to every American con that I've been to for a very long time.
Yeah, he's quite ubiquitous, isn't he? He was at the Carlisle Comic Con last year. A bit of an obscure one, obviously.
Is Carlisle to England what Los Angeles is to the United States?
I'm going to say no. Carlisle, if you're a Doctor Who fan, maybe the only context you've heard of Carlisle is in the 11th Doctor story, High, when the Doctor and Clara are talking, and the Doctor says, the expression ignorance is bliss, but the Doctor doesn't believe that. He says, what's the opposite of bliss? And Clara thinks for a moment and says, Carlisle. That's the perception of Carlisle. I mean, I think because Clara, the character, is supposed to be from Lancashire, which is the county immediately south of Cumbria, where, so there's a bit of kind of northern rivalry there, which you get, like Newcastle Carlisle or Newcastle Sunderland, that kind of thing. That's kind of the perception of Carlisle. It's not a very exciting place. It's the opposite of bliss.
How close are you to the Lake District?
Oh, very close. Yeah, the county I live in is Cumbria. The Lake District is entirely contained in Cumbria. Carlisle is just north of that. So, I would have to drive a very short distance to be in the Lake District.
So, for New Year's Eve, we were invited to my daughter's friend's apartment in Parksville, Brooklyn. And her friend, the parents are Italian immigrants. But it was a lot of school friends and their parents there. So one of the dads who was at the party is from Carlisle.
Oh, right.
And I was able to tell him all I knew about Carlisle. And he was impressed. Most Americans have never heard of it. And he told me this wild story about when his father passed away, his father wanted his ashes to be scattered in the Lake District. But they were there on a very windy or rainy day, so the scattering of the ashes did not go very well. I'm hearing this story at a New Year's Eve party in Brooklyn about 45 minutes after the ball drops. 45 minutes into 2024. It was quite an anecdote. So I think I vowed now that I also want my ashes scattered in the Lake District.
You're very lucky not to get a wet, windy day in the Lake District. But I think the reason that it's wet and that's the reason it's so lush and green and beautiful and there's lakes everywhere is because it rains all the time. It's, the Lake District is fantastic. And if you're familiar with 10th Doctor, those sort of hardback expanded universe books that came out.
The new series adventures.
Yeah, the new series, that's what they call them. Yeah, there's one called, I think it's called Sting of the Zygons, and that is set in the Lake District. And it's about sort of, I think a Victorian or Edwardian. Yeah, thank you.
Wow. Right. And I have the wings. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Victorian or Edwardian kind of big game hunters who head into the Lake District. Because it's a Scarison, I think. It's kind of place where you look at all these enormous lakes and it's all very kind of forests and things like that. You could kind of believe that there would be creatures like that living there.
Growing up on Long Island, my hometown has been mentioned in American sitcoms and a couple of movies have been filmed there. Nothing that's worth seeing. But anytime I hear a biography of Patrick Troughton, and I recently heard this on the animated Underwater, for which I have just recorded the Trap 1 episode with Fraser inside.
Oh, cool.
That will have already aired by the time this comes out, but it has not aired yet. Michael Troughton is interviewed by Toby Hato for episode 1 of the DVD commentary, and he mentions that his father went to drama school on Long Island after the war. And for me, that's not enough. Long Island is, for obvious reasons, long. Mm-hmm. So it has Brooklyn and Queens, the eastern end of New York City. And then it's got Suffolk County and Nassau County. Nassau's where I grew up. And it's very population dense, New York City suburbs. And Suffolk County goes on for a very long way. So it's not enough for me to hear a lot. I want to know where specifically, which county, which town, was Patrick Troughton hanging out in places that I grew up near. But I've never gotten any more details to where on Long Island he was, so the world may never know.
Yeah, I've read his biography that one of his sons wrote, but it was a few years ago now. I can't remember if it goes into any further detail about that. The other...
Everything going okay?
Yes, thank
lovely,
you so much.
Thank you. The other Doctor Who book that's set in Cumbria is Gary Russell's, M.A., Invasion of the Cat People.
Oh, yes, I read that. That must have come out, that was probably 95, I want to say. They came out.
Yeah, it must have been around then, yeah. So that's, it's Kendall, which is kind of Lake District.
Two things I recall about Invasion of the Cat People. Number one, Gary cast all the cats.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the cast list on the back page, it's all the actresses who played female villains in Doctor Who. So Susan Engel is in there. I think he may have had Stephanie Bidney from Galaxy 4, but it was a great, and Eileen Way, a great who's who of all the great female villains in Doctor Who.
I think because it was set contemporaneously in the 90s. The thing I remember about it was Polly looking around the shops in, I think it's Kendall, and thinking, wow, people must be really rich here. because of the prices, because of inflation. But of course, now we're another 30 years on, and if you read the book, everything will seem very, very cheap, probably. So there's an extra layer of irony to that line now.
And the book had a eulogy to River Phoenix, who had just recently died at that point, in the Viper Room, right here in Los Angeles. Those are my biggest memories of that book. So, speaking of Second Doctor, speaking of rain, I suppose it's time to get to the topic of the week. What is your... we're having a My Dinner with Andre-style conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, and I'm having my chicken wings, so my mouth is going to be full. I'll do most of the talking. What is your journey with regard to the Seeds of Death?
The Seeds of Death? I'm pretty sure I read the Target book first, but I can't really remember the circumstances of buying it. Some Target books I can, but that one I can't. My copy, actually, I think it's ex-library, because it says like Sanford Library or something, stamped across the top, not at the top of the book. So when you push the pages together, you can see that.
Yeah.
And then I would have seen the VHS when that came out and bought the VHS. It's a story I really like, and I really enjoy it. I read it entirely on the flight today. So I read two Target books and watched two movies on the flight.
And how long was that flight?
Just over 11 hours.
Oh, and you're still awake.
Yeah, so I'm going to try and be as coherent as possible, but I haven't slept for quite a long time. I tried to get a bit sleep on the plane, maybe got 2 hours altogether, but it's very difficult. The flight had those tables that fold out of the arm, and it seems to be impossible for anybody to take them out or put them away quietly. They always like crash and snap in and out of place. But yeah, I read the book, enjoyed it. It's very fast-paced. Loads of incident. It occurred to me, actually, you know, talking about that thing of, you know, reading a book from the 90s in the 2020s that's set in the 60s. I guess this was written in the 80s, so we're a bit further on from the 60s when the story was made. And where Terence Dix has expanded on the line where Jamie and Zoe are saying, well, you know, can't we help these people when they can't get to the moon because the T-MAT has crapped out. And they said, well, you can't take the TARDIS because it's not suitable for short hops. And in this story, they just say, well, we just got no... The doctor face said, we've got no control over it. It's not ideal for that. I guess by the 80s, we've seen... Oh, thank you.
It's okay.
Thank you
very much. By the 80s, we've seen that the Doctor can do short hops in the TARDIS. We've seen that in Logopolis, and we've seen it in Black Orchid and things like that. So Terence Dix feels the need, or, you know, maybe for the contemporary viewers, explains that the reason they can't do a short hop is because he's been doing some maintenance on the guidance system, and it's in pieces all over the TARDIS floor, and he doesn't, and even if he put it, doesn't got time to put it all back together or whatever.
But that's also very on brand for the Patrick Troughton Doctor.
Yeah.
Because there was the recurring theme in season 6. The TARDIS was always breaking down, and it was invisible for a couple of stories. And
yeah.
It was always, the Doctor was in the power room in Mind Robber, and it broke in Mind Robber, and then it broke again in the Invasion. And then the Hads kicks in, and the Crotons, and it disappears.
And another thing that really stuck out to me reading it this time, and probably more so than watching the serial, is you've got Zoe as the Doctor's companion, and the other female character is Gia Kelly, and they're very similar. But nothing's really made of that. It feels like a little bit of an opportunity where they could have explored that a little bit. Because it's set in the 21st century. I don't think we get an exact year, just the 21st century,
yeah.
Don't we? And Terence Dix either pessimistically or accurately says that women still don't have equality, that, you know, to get on in their careers or to have equal pay, they have to work much harder than men, and to be treated the same, they have to do more, basically, which is very accurate for the 21st century. That hasn't changed from the 80s when he was writing this book.
Very odd point.
Yeah, and then so he describes how Gia Kelly is
she has to be quite just perfect at everything, and she's but it's kind of good in the way that the only other female character is the world expert on T-Man. Her boss doesn't Radner, is it? He doesn't want to risk her because like you're the only person that fully understands it. So it's great that you've got a female character, I think, in that position where she is the most valuable person, but she also has to be less human and to be like that, because she's got to be perfect and not make any errors to be a woman in that position. And then you've also got Zoe, who Dennis describes as having a computer-like brain. So yeah, it's good to me you've got two very similar women there, but you know, they barely interact, and nothing much is made of it. Whereas they could have had an interesting conversation about being that way.
It's one of Terrence's hidden ninja skills. It's one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough in his novelizations. He's very good at putting the world, this fictional world, in context. So, Terrence Stakes is the junior story editor at this point. And to hear him tell it, Peter Bryan and Derek Sherwin were always down the pub or in the BBC club. So he was often in the office by himself. The Brian Hale script for Seeds of Death did not work. And Brian Hale blamed that on not being told changes to the series format, because Fraser Hines was going to leave early, there was going to be another male companion that didn't shake out. And then on the production side, no, we told him well in advance, it's his fault. Terrence ended up writing most of the stories himself. So episodes 3 through 6, which noticeably have a faster and better pace than episodes 1 and 2.
Yeah.
That's all Terrence. So this is basically his story. He wrote most of the script. He probably did a lot more. He dropped some subplots. He made the story a lot tighter than Brian Hales would have had it. Just in chapter 1 alone, he is able to explain about the technology, how T-Man has changed the Earth, how things are better because of T-Man, and yet society is still imperfect because of gender equality, which is still very much an issue now, especially in the States. So Terrence just paints this world for you in just a few paragraphs in chapter 1. He does it so fast, you might not even realize that he's doing it. But it's one of the more memorable parts of the book for me. For me, the TV story is not great, even when Terrence starts picking it up. It's not my favorite Trout, but it's Michael Ferguson's debut, and as a Doctor Who director, he'd already done War Machines. He's one of Doctor Who's most visual and inventive directors, from War Machines and this, and Ambassadors of Death. And then Claws of Axos, he couldn't do much with, but three of his four stories are visual beasts. And Seeds of Death has great visuals, and that's really all in the director.
Yeah, definitely. And I think... The other point I was going to make about the difference in time of it being written is that, you know, this in the 60s, what was it, 67 or 68, the story?
It came out in 69, I think. So probably written in 68.
So it was probably written then and before the moon landing in 69.
Yes.
And he's already... Brian Hales or Terrence Stakes is already looking forward to a point where rocket technology is of the past and people aren't excited by it anymore. And even by the 80s, that probably, when the book is written, that had already happened in terms of not going to the moon anymore and things like that. So, again, an interesting thing from the point of view of him writing in the 80s, where the thing that was predicted nearly 20 years previously had already happened, and you get those nice bits where when they launched the rocket with the Doctor, Jamie and Zoe, and then when they launched the satellite, that these characters have this lovely kind of nostalgia and this love of the, I think he calls it the romance of rocketry, which is a lovely thing, which, you know, he will have lived through, the space race and the moon landing and all that kind of stuff, and when it really captured everyone's imagination, and then seeing it, I guess, kind of fall by the wayside a little bit. So you might not have drawn that out as much if the book had been written a lot earlier, like in the early 70s, I guess.
So it's a bookend, because one of the earlier Troughton. This is the third to last Troughton story. But the fourth Troughton story was the moon base, where they get to the moon before Neil Armstrong, before Apollo 11. Mm-hmm. So the moon base is all about it's the beginning of the era, and it's all about the joy of exploration. And Seeds of Death is the end of the era, and it's all about the humdrum of exploration, and nobody cares anymore. And you can get from London to the moon in 10 seconds. You can commute to work on the moon. And rocketry is kind of a lost science, and only Professor Eldred, the crackpot, has this museum dedicated to travel, and he's the one who helps, along with the doctor, save the day. But you wonder, obviously there was nobody left in the production office who worked on the moon base. It was a complete turnover. So I don't know what Terrence would have been aware of at that point. So I'm almost certain that it wasn't intentional, but it's two stories on the moon, and two very different attitudes of what the moon is like. But it's the same base undersea story.
And two stories with weather control technology as well. Yeah, it did occur to me that he makes no reference to that. He doesn't even have Jamie thinking, oh, I've been to the moon before. Which the ideal place, I guess, to put that would be when they're debating whether Jamie should come in the rocket, because he has no astronaut skills or training or experience whatsoever. And he just wants to come because he thinks he needs to look after them. You know, the point there, I suppose, you know, even if it's not in the original TV story, Terrence Six normally does link things and tie things together like that, would be for Jamie to say, you know, oh, Doctor, I've been to the moon before, you know.
But he... The moon base novelization is Jerry Davis. So Terrence would not have written that.
Yeah, of course.
Terrence was around, but that was back before he was the sole writer.
I do love how Jamie's dialogue is written in... always written in Scots dialect. And you're more across the target, while you... read them all a lot more recent than I have, but the majority of them I've read when I was a kid. Do all writers do that? I know Terrence Dix does. Is that fairly consistent? Like, for example, Jerry Davis?
Jerry Davis had him very, very Scottish. Mm. Because for Jerry Davis, I imagine that being Scottish is being from another planet. Because remember, the moon base has a diverse crew. Mm. Somebody from London, somebody from France, somebody from Sweden. And they're all treated... It's a very Star Trek, The Next Generation view of culture, where every culture has only one trait, and every single member of that culture has the exact same trait. That's Jerry Davis's view of Europe. Mm-hmm. But I think, as we go along, most of the target writers toned down the dialect. Mm-hmm. There's nothing unusual about being Scottish. And when you write a Peter Capaldi book, is Peter Capaldi speaking in dialect? Is Amy Pond speaking in dialect? No.
No, they don't do that, do they? I guess Scottish characters were rarer in the classic series. I don't know, I suppose, again, long time since I've read Doctor Who and the Loch Ness Monster, but I don't know if all the characters there were written in dialect.
So the song by the Proclaimers, 500 Miles.
Yeah.
I'm going to be. That song was made famous in the movie Benny and June, which came out in the early 90s.
Okay.
But the song was old. And the reason the song was in the movie is because the actress who plays June was playing it in her trailer. And the director happened to walk in and hear the song and said, oh, it's a good song, I'll put it in the movie. When that song came out, the Proclaimers were in New York, and they appeared on the David Letterman. David Letterman was a late-night talk show host in the States for 35 years and still does occasional work, but he retired in 2015.
Yeah, we used to get Letterman, and his show's on Netflix now, isn't it? My next guest needs no introduction or whatever it's called.
And he's terrific. But in 1989, he still has his... He was doing his 12:30 a.m. show, and it followed The Tonight Show, followed Johnny Carson, who was the king of late night. Letterman was the next show. So we had the Proclaimers come out, it was probably about 1:15 in the morning towards the end of the show. And the clip of their being on Letterman performing that song 5 years before Benny and June is on YouTube. It's amazing. Letterman really, really enjoyed the song, so he calls the two men over to the stage for an interview after the song. Their Scottish burr was so pronounced, and David Letterman is a Midwesterner living in New York, but he's from the Midwest. He could not understand a word they were saying. They had to repeat everything three times. It's hilarious.
Hi, nice to see you. You're Chris? Nice to see you.
Charlie,
have a seat. Thank you for being here. And the crowd goes crazy. Very nice. Nice to have you here. Where are you guys from?
We're from Edinburgh in Scotland, but we grew up in a town called Auchtermuchty.
I'm sorry, a town called?
Auchtermuchty.
Auchtermuchty.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
It means...
Hell of the boar.
Yeah, in Gaelic it means hell of the boar.
Hell of the poor?
Boar.
Hell of the boar.
Wild boar. Wild pig.
Oh, wild pig.
Yeah.
Are there wild pigs there?
No, there used to be about 300 years ago.
Yeah, because that'd be a perfect tourist attraction if you could get them back.
So that's how Target writers must have felt about Jamie, especially in the 70s.
I may be misremembering this. Not the first part. I know David Tennant is a huge fan of the Proclaimers. I got a feeling they performed at his wedding. That kind of rings a bell. I remember reading that at the time.
I don't know either way, but it sounds so good. I'm going to assume that it happened. That's a story. I don't want to lose that story.
Yeah, it might be something to check and put in the show notes. But I know he's definitely a big fan of them. I remember that's come up in interviews. I've got a feeling maybe when he married Georgia that they performed at the wedding. Yeah, that song. It's not well known in the UK from a movie. It is just a big song that you'll often hear on a night out or anything. And I got a few other popular songs like Letter from America and
yes.
I can't think of any more, but I've been awake for a long time.
And of course, very few folks in America in 1989 knew who the Proclaimers were. They're very young. I think it was their first trip to America. And the song eventually resurfaces 4 years later and becomes enormous.
Yeah,
but at the time, it was just a random, obscure club act, and they did a great job.
Maybe that's when they wrote Letter from America.
Well, ask David Tennant.
Yeah.
We can ask Billie Piper when we see her on Saturday. Maybe she was at David Tennant's wedding.
Yeah, that's a good point. I bet she was.
We're doing the guest reception with Billie Piper on Saturday night, unless there's a schedule change. So yeah. We're going to get 5 minutes with her at our table. We'll have to ask.
That's a great point.
Who performed at David Tennant's wedding?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask. I bet she doesn't get asked that very often.
No, I asked a lot about what is it like to work with Rebecca Davies, Christopher Eccleston, who's your favorite doctor, what is the deal with your ex-husband? But no one ever asks.
Yeah.
Who was the band performing at David Tennant's wedding? So, continuing on my theme of stealing shamelessly from Darren Mooney's movies podcast, the 250. Tomorrow, as we record this, I'll be moderating the Deathmatch 60x60 panel, the 60 greatest Doctor Who stories of the last 60 years. 10 panelists, 6 stories each, 60 seconds each. We're going to get an interesting cross-section of what Doctor Who stories are beloved by members of the Gallifrey-going public. Mm-hmm. For you, speaking objectively, does The Seeds of Death belong on a list of the 60 best Doctor Who TV stories of all time, or the last 60 years?
For me, no. I like it, but I think what lets it down, and it's the same in the book, is the Doctor building basically a gun at the end.
Want to look at the dessert menu?
Okay, thank you.
No, thanks.
No, thank you. It's the Doctor basically building a gun in the near the story's climax, and when the door opens, I can't remember if this is in the TV story. I watched the first 4 episodes on, I'm not sure what day it is anymore, Wednesday, but I only had time to watch the first 4. And when the Doctor's tooled up with his solar gun, and when the door opens, the Ice Warrior's gone, and in the book at least, he says the Doctor was really disappointed. He says, "Oh, I could have destroyed it then," which is pretty far from the usual characterization of the Doctor, and the kind of characterization that I like of the Doctor. And then he does kind of go on a bit of a killing spree after that with it as well. So I think that's probably the thing that
as much as I think it's a good story up to that point, and it's fast paced, and I like the Ice Warriors, and I think the whole idea is just a good idea that, you know, humanity has become dependent on the Transmat, and they need to go back to rockets. It's just a generally cool idea that you can immediately get on board with. But yeah, there's Trump stories that I would put higher than that for that reason, really. I think the bloodthirsty nature of the Doctor's resolution would put me off. How about for you?
It was similar to this to A Day of the Daleks, where the Doctor casually shoots Ogrons, and Terrence put it in the novelization, not seeing any problem. Only later on does the idea crystallize. The Doctor was never cruel or cowardly.
Yeah.
Doesn't do that thing. So the special edition for DVD of Day of the Daleks and on streaming does not have... That's been taken out. Deleted. Cut out.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah. It's Doctor Who's Han shot first moment, isn't it?
Yes, well, I am a firm believer that Han shot first. And my daughter to this day, I have only ever shown her the original, either the despecialized edition or the silver screen edition of episode 4. It doesn't even say, just a Star Wars, it doesn't say episode 4. So I've never shown her the version where Han either shoots second or simultaneously.
Right.
There's no other way for me. Second question, moving from best to favorite. Is the Seeds of Death on your personal list of your 60 best Doctor Who stories? In other words, is it a comfort watch for you?
I haven't crafted a top 60, but it's probably in the lower half of my overall stories and of my Troughtons as well. I think it's one of those stories that, you know, by virtue of the fact that it still exists, it's one that, you know, I go to more often than maybe the animations. But, you know, I don't enjoy it as much as The Mind Robber or Web of Fear or Enemy of the World or The War Games. You know, any of those kind of, for me, top tier Troughtons.
So for me, I've gone back and forth on this story over the years. I hate, maybe hate is too strong a word, I loathe this common complaint that a given serial is two episodes too long.
Yeah.
These were serials, not movies. Mm-hmm. You have to have recap and repetition because there's no guarantee that your audience saw last week's episode.
Yeah.
And the first Doctor Who story recovered as an off-air VHS recording is The Space Pirates, one serial later. Mm-hmm. So there are no existing copies of Seeds of Death between 1969 and I guess the airing in the US in 1986 when it first came here. So 5 minutes of every episode are recap, so it's repetitive. With that being said, it is a conceptual mistake to have the Doctor land in a museum and not get out of the museum until the end of episode 2. So Troughton doesn't get to do what Troughton does best until he sees the Ice Warriors later on in the story. And then Troughton has to get a week's vacation. So one sixth of the story he's not in.
Yeah, that is unfortunate.
I think Michael Ferguson is one of the best directors of the 60s. And the way that he keeps the Ice Warriors hidden for the cliffhanger, and the way that he used light and silhouette, it's a gorgeous story to look at, especially with the exterior. Well, if I'm watching the story 25 minutes at a time and I'm reading the DVD info text, I enjoy it. When I watch it for my pilgrimage, my famous Twitter pilgrimage, this would have been in 2021, I was kind of bored. And also, season 6 became a drag to me because you go after Fury from the Deep, Wheel in Space, wasn't crazy about, Dominators, Hi Fraser, not a big fan. Yes, Mind Robbers in my top 60. Yes, The Invasion in my top 60. Still working. Seeds of Death, bit of a slog. Space Pirates, I like it more than a bit of a slog. But then War Games is Titanic. War Games is also my top 60.
Yeah.
But after a while, I was getting tired of season 6. So my tweets for this story, and I've deleted my Twitter, so I don't know if they exist anymore, but I was not a big fan of this one, watching it back in early 2021. I enjoy elements of it in isolation, but no, it would not be in either of my top 60s. So if you are a new fan of Doctor Who, and you have not seen all of the classic series, do you recommend that listeners pause this episode, stream Seeds of Death to a local device, either on BBC iPlayer or Tubi, or order the DVD, watch the DVD, and the text commentary, and the audio commentary with Terrence Nix, and the documentaries, and then come back and resume listening to this episode?
I would recommend anybody that hasn't seen it should do that, because it's a very enjoyable story. It's the team of the Doctor, Jamie and Zoe. I always enjoy seeing them. As you say, visually, it's really well directed. There's a bit where one of the characters on the moon base is blown up and is thrown over the desk, and that's like right out of Star Trek, isn't it? You don't see that to that extent that often. The location stuff as well, when they're out and the foam is in the sort of the grounds of the TMAC control place, that all looks really good as well. It's funny, just reminding me, something just triggered a memory there, that before I ever saw this story, I'm not sure, but there was, it was either 30 Years in the TARDIS, or there was another documentary, maybe a little bit before that, called Resistance is Futile.
I've heard of that, yes.
Which was this BBC Two thing, and it was mainly just made up of clips, and it was presented. In inverted commas, by the Anorak, which is just an Anorak on a mannequin sort of thing. There's nobody inside it, and with a voiceover. So whichever one of those, you know, when I was a kid, and I'd watch these over and over again because there's clips and stories that I hadn't seen. And the clip where the Doctor says, "You can't kill me, I'm a genius." And the two ice warriors turn to each other and go, "Genius." And I always really loved that clip. Because as much as Trout and gunning down ice warriors is not very Doctorish, that way of disarming them by saying something like that, and then this the ice warriors being, you know, from what it looks like in that clip anyway, being a bit taken aback and looking at each other going, "Ooh, genius." I really, really liked, and I remember wanting to see that story for a long time. And then when I finally did see it in context, it's still a really great moment in the story.
And it's a counterpoint to Angus Leeny in the original Ice Warriors, because he goes to them for help, thinking they're on his side, anti-government, anti-science, anti-quarantine, and they need trained scientists, so they kill him as being useless. So now the Doctor is going to them as a genius rather than as a anti-vaxxer, anti-masker, anti-government, off-the-grid type. Very good cast in this story, too, because you have Ronald Lee Hunt, later comes back and plays a similar role in Revenge of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
When I first saw the story, Revenge of the Cybermen was on my top 60.
Right.
So I like it for that reason. You have Christopher, I don't know if it's pronounced Cole or Cole, but he later plays Stubbs in The Mutants, which is a very good performance.
Mm.
And he's a smaller role in this story, too. You have Harry Taub, but he's given a very big build-up in the novelization, and he's killed in the first chapter. But he's very good on screen while he's there, and he later shows up again 2 years later in Terror of the Autons in another memorable death scene. And not only that, he played the Brigadier's Uncle Mario in The Ghost of Endspace, which our friend Kyra recently discussed on the 200 TV podcast.
Right, yeah. It's got quite a big cast, hasn't it? And quite a high body count as a result, a lot of people getting gunned down by ice warriors in it. This isn't about the book, but that effect, the Miralon, isn't it, that they use for the gun, I think looks really good. I'm pleased that when they brought the ice warriors back for the new series, they used a version of that, you know, they paid homage to that effect. It looks painful, I guess, you know, that when someone gets hit by it. So.
And I don't know if this is intentional on RTD's part, but the Santaran stratagem to poison the sky is the same plot. Aliens terraforming Earth to make it inhospitable to humans, but hospitable to them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
So this is a question I haven't asked in a while, but by this point, it's the end of 1986. Terrence Nix is now down to one or two books a year instead of 8, 9, or 10. this book is about 150 pages. Whereas not too long ago, Terrence was doing 100-page books between Destiny of the Daleks, mm-hmm. Robots of Death, Image of the Fendall. This is Terrence with time to think and breathe. Is this, The Seeds of Death, the definitive Terrence Dix novelization?
I don't think it is definitive. No. I think it's very enjoyable. It goes along at a great pace. But I think, yeah, I think some of the things I mentioned earlier, I think Terrence Dix at his peak. He gets the continuity really spot on, doesn't he? So, you know, I think he maybe would have done the homework about the fact that Jamie had been to the moon before, right, that they'd been to a weather control station before, that kind of thing. I think maybe he would have nudged the doctors in a bit more in the direction of not wanting to carry guns around, not wanting to shoot ice warriors, and not like being disappointed when they open the door and there isn't one there that he can vaporize. So yeah, as enjoyable as it is, I don't think it's his best work.
Kill the Moon, which is a controversial Doctor Who story, and I'll point out, speaking again about Darren Mooney, he wrote the Black Archive for Kill the Moon. So, in Kill the Moon, they land on the moon in the year 2050. Is that meant to be the same base from the moon base, and or the same base from The Seeds of Death?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Because the way that I see it, it takes place 20 years before the moon base. And I think there's a line at the end of Kill the Moon about needing to control the gravity on Earth because of the new moon.
Yeah.
I believe that is meant to be an origin story for the moon base in the moon base. Does it have any nexus, though, do you think, to The Seeds of Death?
I'd never thought about that. That's a nice idea, though, isn't it? That, if the new infant creature in the moon isn't quite as big, so doesn't exert the same gravity or something like that, they need to invent the gravitron.
Yes.
I'm going to accept that headcanon. I like Kill the Moon.
Well, we are going to be meeting several Target writers this weekend. Tomorrow, Friday, there's a panel with all three of the authors of the brand new David Tennant /14 specials. So James Goss,
Mark Morris,
Gary Russell.
Yeah.
He's been on this show before.
I think it would be an interesting panel, because the Target books have come out so swiftly after the episodes. I suppose how long they had to write them. Because the episodes were in the can for quite a long time, weren't they? They were filmed way, way ahead of the 60th anniversary. I suppose it'd be interesting to find out what access they had, you know, to the scripts, the episodes, what Russell T. Davis maybe told them about what was being set up. I read Wild Blue Yonder on the plane over, which is the Mark Morris one. And it made me wonder about the Mavity thing.
Ready for the check?
Yeah, thank you. Two, please. because it's not gone into that much. But I think when the first time that Donna says Mavity, the Doctor says, oh, file that away for later. But then it doesn't come up again in the book. And the Doctor says gravity, and Donna's confused as she is in the episode, and goes gravity, and he goes Mavity without skipping a beat. So it's interesting whether and they're obviously not going to reveal what they know, but whether they know where that's going, or whether they're just transcribing what happened.
That'll be your question to ask on the panel tomorrow. I know when I sat down with Gary at LI Who, and this was one of my November 2023 60th anniversary episodes, Gary had already written and turned in the manuscript for Starbeast before he came to this convention last year.
Right.
So he finished writing that book 12 months ago, and the episode doesn't air until 3 months ago, as you and I have this conversation.
That's so interesting to, you know, in terms of not knowing what the critical or fan reaction will be. But I suppose for Gary Russell, he'd have been in the same position with the TV movie, because I think with the TV movie, the novelization came out before the episode was broadcast, didn't it? Like it was few days or a week before. Yeah.
And he had written in material in the TV movie novelization, which harkened back to the previous Seven Doctors. And there was a lot of continuity, which I believe the editors of the line took out But he saved that material and he performed it when I was at the Chicago, the Visions in Chicago in 1996. And I had that book autographed by him, and then it was lost, and then the repurchase of my stuff last year. But I believe he reinstated that material for the new Target reissue of the Teen Movie novelization.
Right. Cool, I haven't read that yet. Yeah, because I think the original one did have a bit where in the Eye of Harmony of seeing the previous Doctors or something like that, there was a little bit left on, wasn't there, where maybe it cycled through the regenerations and the Master sees them go through up to the Eighth Doctor and then says, oh, this one's so young or something like that. It's been a long time since I read it, but I think that was one of the things that stuck out to me that was
Does
different.
Does anybody want to do room charge?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we're reaching the end of our dinner conversation, and we have not gotten nearly as deep as Wallace Shawn or Andre Gregory. So if you could ask me one deep question, ask me anything, and I'll do the same for you.
Oh, I can't think of anything. You ask me first, and give me time to think.
You have been a Doctor Who podcaster now for 7 years. I think Trap One debuted in early 2017.
That's right.
How has being a podcaster enriched your life? And as a corollary to that, how much longer do you think you will go on? You step back from Trap One a little bit. You're no longer in every episode, but how long do you see Trap One running, and how proud are you of the work you've done?
I think it's enriched my life massively because to be honest, before I started podcasting, I didn't really know any of the Doctor Who fans. So the people I've met in the circle of friends, obviously Pleasant Company included, that I've met through that, but also, you know, our fellow co-hosts, Pete, Cy, Conrad, Denise, and UK Jason.
Yes.
I'm very tired, just making sure.
And then, of course, we can't forget Keith and Fraser and Cy.
Yeah, and everybody that I've met through doing it, that's been massively enriching. I think there was a question on Twitter the other day about whether Doctor Who Twitter has been a good thing or a bad thing, and Cy, you know, basically the whole height of you, what Cy said about that in terms of the people that he's met and the friendships forged. So I obviously wouldn't know any of the Doctor Who fans without it. I imagine it just running and running and running. Bringing on a board like, you know, you and the other co-hosts, it's been brilliant because, well, I think at the time, a lot of things were sort of coming up again, where there's a lot of stories where I'd reviewed them when the vinyl came out, and then the animations were coming out, or they were coming out in different formats and things, and I didn't want to sort of maybe talk about a story that I'd already talked about and things, so it's good to still cover it, but just to get different opinions and different insights like that. And then there is stuff that I'm just not that into that, you know, somebody else would be, you know, like the way you're a massive Hartnell fan. And I like Hartnell, but, you know, you bring a passion and a deep knowledge to it that, you know, that really enhances those episodes. So, and as we all, you know, different co-hosts bring different things to it. So, you know, everyone's got their own kind of areas of expertise and things like that. So it's great. So, as far as I said, it'll just run and run as long as we're all happy to do it.
Well, I thank you for making me part of the family, and I would agree. The friends that I've made through your show, I mean, this is not the first time you and I have met. When you were in New York, you and your wife made a point to have me after dinner.
Yeah, that was lovely, yeah. I really appreciate you coming out and everything, and met up with everybody now. You know, even Denise, who lives in Norway, she came up for a convention and over to meet up with her. So it's that's all been really lovely. Well, I'll ask you the same question. Not this maybe question about how long Doctor Who literature will run, because you will eventually run out of books.
Yes.
But yeah, I suppose in terms of going from being, you know, a guest and a co-host to having your own show where you are it's your name above the marquee sort of thing. How that's changed for you?
I never envisioned having my own show because I did my first guest spot on Trap One in 2017. You had me on two or three times a year. During the pandemic, I ended up offering to guest host, but you had to miss a couple of shows. And then you made me a permanent panelist a year or so later. And co-hosting, guest hosting was hard because we had terrible audio problems my very first time out. I had to find my feet the hard way. Later on during the pandemic, somebody pitched the idea of doing a show with me and then ghosted me. Wait a minute, I can just do this myself. So I started that idea. It was a debate show, and I recorded 6 episodes with 4 guests. And I didn't know about, you know, using Skype to record or using Zencast, so I just recorded the audio, so it was me talking and the other person over the speakers. And the audio quality was poor, and I didn't really have a format or a direction. So I never aired any of those episodes. And then I've already done a blog covering in detail the first 16 Target books. And there's already a Target podcast doing the books in story order. Why don't I do the corollary to that? Why don't I do the books in publication order like my blog, Doctor Who Novels at WordPress? And I started that at the end of 2021. And I figured this is just me reading out my script, half an hour episodes, that's it. And then after 4 weeks of talking to myself, I realized I need help. So I invited Stacy, I invited you, I invited Tony Witt from the other Targets podcast, and some other friends, and quickly it shows you where Doctor Who Literature's format is a failure of the imagination, because now I have more guests than I have books remaining. So at some point we are going to switch to a 2 guest per show format. We want to talk about the TV, we want to talk about the book.
Oh, cool.
Probably for the McCoy years, where the books get a lot longer and more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But I've made some amazing friends and contacts, and I've gotten an interview, and I've gotten much more comfortable. Even though my day job for many years has involved speaking in court and or arguing or doing related tasks, interviewing is still not my comfort zone. Speaking on a panel in front of 200 Doctor Who fans is not my comfort zone. I have trepidations about moderating Deathmatch tomorrow, although I'm sure it'll be fine once I get started. But it took me a while to go into this. And if you listen to the earliest episodes, I think that I have... Even if I do say so myself, I've become a much better host and interviewer than I was 2.5 years ago when the show started. So this has been a wonderfully positive experience, to the point where somebody waiting online for a hotel shuttle, after hearing me say 6 words, recognizes me.
That's brilliant. And congratulations on it, because it's a brilliant podcast. It's one of the first ones when I've got the new podcast, you know, that come out of a weekend or early in the week. I always put it on first. It's always very entertaining, very interesting. I always learn loads of stuff about the story. So, and you know, you've had a great feedback from like quite high profile people as well in the fandom, like Andrew Smith and people like that. So, congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some guests that I never would have envisioned being able to speak to in a million years. I've had many authors, I've had people involved with the show directly. I've had some of my favorite Black Archives writers, James Cooley Smith, Ian Potter, phenomenal, phenomenal conversations. Even if I do say so myself.
Sorry, I forgot what we're doing.
Mark was trying to escape without paying the bill.
You
can put it in there. Thank you, I'll be back.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was your shock eye moment from the 2 doctors.
Yeah.
It's a $20 note.
I just started rolling in the conversation, I forgot.
Well, Mark, I can't thank you enough. I'm very happy to see you again for the first time in a year and a half, and I hope you're going to have a great time with your first galley. There is no other convention like galley for sheer size and program. There are 5 programming tracks, so every hour you have to decide between one of 5 different things, whether it's an interview or a fan panel or a meetup. And I don't know if there's a video. There's often a video. I've never been to the video room here, but they screen episodes. So there's a lot going on. Plus, there's the dance party. There's the karaoke, which starts tonight. There's the masquerade, which Jan is involved in. There's all the guests. We're going to do LobbyCon now that we're finished eating. So you're going to meet a whirlwind of people, and I hope you make some great new friends, not just me. And you end up getting some great material for the Trap 1 episode that we're going to record at the end of this weekend.
Yes, yeah, looking forward to that. And thank you very much. Very excited for it. I'm going to try and stay up as long as possible tonight so that I can get into the local time zone as quickly as possible. It's been a very long day, so I'm just going to try and stay coherent and awake as long as I can.
Well, for podcasting terms, I'll speak to you on the next Trap 1 or DW Lit. And for galley terms, I'll see you in about 5 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Doctor Who, The Seeds of Death, by Terence Dix, televised as The Seeds of Death, teleplay by Brian Hales, episodes 1 and 2, and Terence Dix, episodes 3 through 6, screen credit to Brian Hales, televised in January through March 1969, paperback release date December 4th, 1986, target book number 112, cover artist Tony Mazzaro. Returning to Earth in the 21st century, the Doctor, Jamie, and Zoe immediately find themselves caught in the midst of a crisis. TMAT, a form of instantaneous transportation essential to the smooth running of life on Earth, is going disastrously wrong. The Doctor discovers that the TMAT base on the Moon has been taken over by a group of ice warriors, led by the villainous Slarr. Their home a desolate and dying planet, the Martian invaders see Earth as a world ripe for conquest. But before they can colonize Earth, they must dramatically alter its atmosphere, and so they unleash the Seeds of Death. Question: what's the difference between a strong Terence Dix novelization and a weaker one? Answer: about 30 pages. Seeds of Death is 148 pages long, and while I am not the biggest defender of the six-part TV serial that birthed it, the book is a banger. The first page, Terence being Terence. Literally page one, describing TMAT and setting the scene for the adventure to come. Quote, if you wanted to travel, you simply stepped in a booth, dialed, dematerialized, and reappeared at your destination. As a result, the air was clean, the fuel crisis was over, the accidents of travel a thing of the past. Silently, swiftly, efficiently, TMAT moved man and all the products of his skill about the planet. And nothing ever went wrong. Until one day, .. If the rest of the book has passages where Terence is on autopilot, well, it's good autopilot. He describes TMAT control with familiar phrases like, quote, countless rows of instrument panels, or Miss Kelly being, quote, icily beautiful. A page 3 sentence remains one of the best future predictions in the range. Quote, even now, in the 21st century, the equality of women was still more theoretical than practical. It remained as true as ever that to attain the highest rank, a woman had to be not simply as good as, but measurably better than her male colleagues. Page 5 is the typical Terence battle, present on the page but not explicit on TV, between the, quote, new breed of executives and the practical, nuts-and-bolts old-timers. We saw this in the horror of Fang Rock novelization, too. The office politics here are delicious. Miss Kelly loathing her boss, Commander Radnor, even though he's very fond of her. Little of this comes through on television. Osgood and Miss Kelly are rivals for the same promotion, for example. Osgood is played by the terrific Harry Taub, and it's a shame to lose him just a few scenes into episode 1, or page 11, of the book. This is Terence's 57th novelization, though that number changes if you consider the two junior Doctor Who novelizations that I didn't cover on this show. 57 novelizations, and this is target book number 112, which is a misnomer because book 106, Vengeance on Varos by Philip Martin, is long overdue and won't be out for months and months on this weekly show. So unless you're a brand new listener, again, welcome. I have a prodigious back catalog. I encourage you to dip in, but whatever you do, don't start at the beginning, because it took a while for the show to find its voice. Didn't even have guests until episode 5. And I used to do things like April Fool's Day episodes that got a fraction of my audience, so I eventually stopped doing them. Where was I? Ah, yes. Unless you're a brand new listener, we already know Terence's usual magic tricks. Stock descriptions of the regulars, nifty 10-word descriptions of secondary and tertiary characters, and particular reliance on adjectives like strange or savage or gleaming. So what we'll do now is compare this book to all the other targets that have come out in 1986. December now, the final paperback of the year, we've already had 7 new authors, 7 first-time target novelizations from William Ems, bringing us Galaxy 4 in April, to Alison Benjamin and the Celestial Toymaker in November, 2 weeks ago on this show. These new authors brought a dizzying array of styles, Pip and Jane speaking in SAT-level vocabulary, Ems writing one chapter per episode, Benjamin kind of giving up on the story after the episode 2 cliffhanger, Glenn McCoy throwing away the TV script and starting over by telling the story on shuffle, Terence Dudley using 14 words where 3 would have sufficed, and Victor Pemberton giving us an Ian Martyr body horror novel on steroids. Oh, and bonus credit to Ems for writing a second Doctor Who book the same year, for a different publisher, and in a different format, last week's episode. Coming back to Terence Dix after all of that is a delight. Boy, did I miss him. Chapter 2, man. 2 full pages of exposition describing the Doctor, and then Jamie and Zoe pointing out their costumes, and the twinkles in their eyes, and their various points of origin. Professor Eldred, the character who spent 6 weeks in the spring of 1969, standing on the same mark all episode long, and scowling, gets one of Terence's master descriptions. Quote, "He looked exactly like a professor," thought Zoe, "an old man, still vigorous, with wings of white hair framing a high-domed bald head." Radnor on page 26 has, quote, "the accomplished courtesy of the practiced politician. I mean, Ems and McCoy and Dudley and Benjamin don't write with that clarity or wit." The only thing missing from Chapter 2 is the very long set of ad-lib double entendres that could only have come from Pat Troughton, Fraser Hines, and one-time Doctor Who literature guest, Wendy Padbury.
Oh, my word.
Hey, look at size of this one, Doc.
Yes, my word, Jamie.
Oh, Doctor, look.
Pretty large. Hey.
Doctor.
Oh. Look at that.
This is Terence's second, and sadly last time, writing for the Ice Warriors. And the first was with an asterisk, The Monster of Peladon, episode 62, where the Ice Warriors are only in half the story and aren't revealed as the bad guys till the very end. Brian Hales had their other 2 TV adventures, but here the Warriors are villains throughout, and they're introduced in style on page 30, the episode 1 cliffhanger, with Terence's trademark parallel sentence structure. They were, dot, 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 they were, dot, 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 they were Ice Warriors. You can hear the cliffhanger sting from there, even though that wasn't invented for another year after this was broadcast, even though this book does not have audio cues. The value of Terence is in what he adds and what he leaves out. What he adds are small but effective commentaries on the script to paper over implausibilities or bits of obsolete continuity. The Doctor couldn't pilot the TARDIS in 1969, but he could in 1986, so Chapter 4 adds a Doctor POV explanation as to the TARDIS guidance system being in pieces and not steerable, quote, in its present condition. Also, time lapses to cover the implausible speed with which Professor Eldred's rocket is put into service. As for what's missing, unscripted byplay, usually between Troughton and Hines, added in rehearsal. In the book, the Doctor assures everyone that the rocket is in good hands. That's from the script. In rehearsal and on TV, there's an added beat of Jamie scoffing and the Doctor deflecting. It's interesting that the best dialogue of the Hales scripted portions of the story were ad-libs from the main cast. Chapter 5 features some quick one-sentence bursts of characterization. The Doctor privately thinks that he won't need Miss Kelly's help to repair T-Mat. Eldred is privately sad that his rocket took off successfully without him in it. Miss Kelly had a weakness for Osgood, quote, perhaps because of the fact that he was one of the few men who didn't seem in the least afraid of her. And Zoe loved nothing more than passing on a bit of scientific instruction, quote, especially to Jamie. Terence does all this so fast and effectively that it is easy to overlook. Episode 3 is where the TV story finally starts to move, not coincidentally because this is where Terence became the story's uncredited scriptwriter. This is when the Doctor finally becomes aware that he's in an Ice Warrior story. Left up to Brian Hales, that might not have happened until Episode 5. But the value in the novelization, and this is a 149-page book, is Terence constantly injecting character notes. In the Episode 3 material, the Doctor likes to tinker. He crosses his fingers behind his back when he doesn't believe what he's saying, and Slar the Ice Lord respects Miss Kelly's strength, even as he's threatening to kill her. I realize I'm not being entirely fair to the TV story, which benefits from excellent Michael Ferguson direction, he who also made the War Machines and the Ambassadors of Death such visual feasts, and who did the best he could with Claws of Axos. But the stuff that works best on TV is the direction and staging, which doesn't always translate into book form, so Terence enlivens the scripts in his own way. That being said, Terence on page 64, chapter 7, gives a long passage both giving a plot explanation for the intricate moon base sets and canonizing Ferguson's direction. I live for expository passages like these. Nobody does them better. Starting on page 64, the Doctor entered cautiously from the airlock, paused to consult Professor Eldred's map, then hurried along the gloomy corridors of the moon base. The base had been constructed many years ago, in the early days of space travel, and it had been built on a large and ambitious scale. The intention was that it should be almost a moon city, the first step on man's journey to the other planets. The rise of TMAT and the subsequent loss of interest in space travel beyond the moon had put an end to all this. A relatively small central complex was used by TMAT, and much of the rest of the base was disused and deserted. The enormous metal dome was a maze of twisting metal corridors, abandoned control rooms, and deserted storage areas. Some, though not all, of the corridor walls were faced with highly polished metal that reflected twisted shapes like a distorting mirror. Every now and again, the Doctor would see some malformed shape creeping towards him, only to realize with relief that he was looking at his own image, reflected in some curved corridor wall. The effect was particularly striking at the junction points where a number of corridors met, and more than once the Doctor found himself faced with a whole crowd of advancing doctors. It was an eerie journey, and the Doctor was very glad when he reached the solar energy storeroom. Cautiously, he moved inside. A slight fix on page 66, the Doctor is given extra dialogue to explain to Phipps why he wants to destroy TMAT. On TV, the scene cuts off with Phipps' horrified reaction. While we lose Jamie's dismissive TV reaction, women, about Zoe's difficulty reading a map, thank goodness, Terrence also wryly mocks the human's preternatural ability to hide in plain sight from the ice warriors, Zoe on page 70, quote, "There was very little shelter behind the wall strut, and if the creature had turned even slightly, they would certainly have seen them. Luckily, it did not, lumbering straight ahead on its way," end quote. The back half of the book falls into the typical Target pattern. Episodes 1 through 3 had taken up 8 chapters and 80 luxurious pages. Episodes 4 through 6, however, take up just 7 chapters and 68 rather quick pages. Episode 4 is easily disposed of in 23 pages of text, one of which is 2.5 lines of print at the end of Chapter 9. Patrick Troughton was on vacation for Episode 4, and any Troughton-era story which loses Troughton for a week suffers seriously plot-wise and pace-wise. Looking at you, Evil of the Daleks and the Wheel in Space in particular, 75% of the magic of the Troughton era is due to Troughton himself. So this material, Terrence flies through. There's a bigger body count in the book, Terrence giving more detail to how many humans die from the initial dispatch of Ice Warrior seeds of death, arriving in TMAT centers, but this is otherwise bare-bones material. However, the pace and the tone in the episode 4 chapters is again vintage peak Terrence. Massive body count. Not just many extras, but also Brent, a named character, even if disposable and quaternary to the plot, played by Rick Felgate, brother-in-law of Michael Ferguson, the director, and who was given small parts in each of Ferguson's first 3 Who serials. We also lose Phipps, played by Christopher Call, who would go on to have a larger part in another serial, largely rewritten by Terrence, as Stubbs, in the John Pertwee story The Mutants, and he's one of the best things about that serial. So while the Doctor is off for the week, the humans aren't doing too well. The Ice Warriors are implacable and relentless, which makes them scarier and arguably more effective here than in their debut story, although that one too has a satisfyingly high body count. Chapter 11 retains what I always took to be an on-screen blooper. Patrick Troughton returning to the show in Episode 5 after a week off, his character waking up and calling for Victoria, who left in the fourth-to-last serial of Production Season 5, and here we are more than halfway through Production Season 6. Terrence explains away the Doctor as, quote, "realized he was a bit astray in his companions." So either Victoria was the scripted line, which seems unlikely, or Terrence liked the blooper, as it reflected the confused mental state of a Doctor just recovering consciousness. In Chapter 12, we again meet the quintessential Terrence Dix character, Sir James Gregson. We will see Sir James and his ilk again and again during Terrence's coming 5 full seasons as script editor during the Pertwee era, the unqualified civil servant who barges into a bad situation and makes it worse. Terence loves this archetype, and pages 108 and 109, Gregson's first scene is a delight. Quote, Gregson did everything briskly, since he was the type who confused activity with efficiency. The thing was, in his view, to be seen to be doing something. It didn't much matter what. He was a slight, fussy, balding man, and those who were forced to work with him said he could turn a difficulty into a disaster in record time. And then, quote, Gregson didn't listen, semicolon, he never did. Chapter 13 features other Terence trademarks. Page 114, quote, exercising his usual talent for taking charge without really trying, the Doctor was holding forth to an enraptured audience. On the next page, remembering that Terence includes menus, if not recipes, in nearly every book, Jamie and Zoe dine on fruit and cordials. On page 117, Terence gives the game away a bit early, if you're reading the books in story order, which is exactly why I don't, by crediting the Doctor's resilience to the Ice Warrior seed pods with his, quote, Time Lord constitution, bearing in mind that Terence hadn't invented the Time Lords yet when he wrote this Episode 5 script. The script also contains a very dated 1969 vintage joke about psychoanalysis. Hardy har har. Chapter 13 also features the death of Fuchsum. We are running out of page count at this point. Episode 6 will only take up 20 pages of text, but Terence does get across the emotional weight of Fuchsum's noble self-sacrifice. However, the Episode 5 cliffhanger is truncated. In the book, the Doctor says, "Oh no!" only once. But that's not how he said it on TV. No, sir. Not by a long shot. The Episode 6 material in the book, dare I say it, is a damp squib, a bit condensed dialogue-wise compared to the TV original, and with the very early Terence Dix having the Doctor resort to a lot more direct violence than we're used to from Mr. Never Cruel or Cowardly, like blasting the Ice Warriors down with a portable heat gun, or steering the Martian fleet into the sun, which was a horrible thing when the Cybermen did to the humans back in the moon base a couple of seasons earlier. I do like the valedictory paragraph at the end, though. Page 148, quote, people usually started asking awkward questions at about this stage, and the Doctor did hate goodbyes. More importantly, he was well aware that people would expect him to go on solving their problems for them. Radnor, Miss Kelly, Professor Eldred, and the rest would manage perfectly well on their own if they ever stopped wrangling. If they ever stopped wrangling. Which was all they did in episodes 1 and 2 of the serial, before Terence took over the bulk of scriptwriting duties. While Seeds of Death is neither his best TV script nor his best novelization, the book does have a lot of punch-your-fist-in-the-air moments, and sustains its narrative drive for most of its length, thanks to Terence's embellishments and running editorial commentary. The book does take off. Perhaps it doesn't quite reach the moon, but at least it gets partway there. Next time, on Doctor Who Literature, we have reached the end of 1986. Next week, a bonus episode, and then we return to 1987 in Target format. Apart from my interview with Mark over dinner at Galley, I did record several other interviews at Gallifrey 1, including one I'm very proud of, a sit-down with Gary Russell, to talk about his novelization of The Star Beast. Also, several other conversations recorded on site, some of which you might have heard if you listened to the Trap 1 Gallifrey Breakdown episode, but which I'm going to present here as an encore for those of you who are not Trap 1 listeners. And if you're not, why not? After that, we are going to be discussing a Target novelization, but not of a TV episode, and of a book that does not carry a Target number. There was no TV novelization put out in January 1987. Instead, the only book released that month in paperback was the novelization of an Eric Sayward radio play featuring the Sixth Doctor and Perry, which helped bridge the hiatus gap between the end of season 22 and the Trial of a Time Lord season. So in 2 weeks, join a new friend of the show and myself to discuss Eric Sayward's Slipback. That's the next 2 weeks on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. The executive producer is David Barsky. This episode was produced by Jim Sangster and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Mark, from Trap One. The theme song to Big Blue Marble was written by Richard Berman. Music composed by Paul Bayerjean. Vocals by Whitney Kershaw. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Growing closer, no need to be afraid, our troubles start to fade as we get closer. Together is a word we must learn to understand.
Direction Point! Direction Point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.